Welcome to ADAI, Author-Driven Artificial Intelligence, the podcast that shows you how to leverage the power of chat-based AI in your business. I'm your host, Laura Helmley, and this is my co-host. Together, we'll explore this cutting-edge tool, its legal and ethical implications, and the delicate balance between human creativity and artificial intelligence. So buckle up and let's dive in.
Diving into a Turing test is just like, it's a test of a computer, of an artificial intelligence, if it can trick a human into thinking that the computer is human. One example we've talked about in the past where the AI succeeded in the Turing test, when they set it up on Fiverr to solve a CAPTCHA.
Right.
Yeah. Because like there was still a person as the go-between where they were typing in like, oh, this is what this person said. How are you going to respond? And then that was a successful Turing test on the computer's part.
Yeah, so Alan Turing was a scientist in 1950.
He cracked the Enigma machine, I think.
Enigma really?
I'm pretty sure. Same guy, Alan Turing.
Wow.
Yeah, so he's a British scientist.
This is a test of a machine's ability to exhibit intelligent behavior equivalent to or indistinguishable from that of a human. Okay, so Turing proposed that a human evaluator would judge natural language conversations between a human and a machine, just like what you were saying. And the machine has not been able to pass this for many, many years.
Yeah, usually there's like not with any consistency. Large consistency. Yeah, that's the word.
Yeah, but now.
Now.
Now it is passing the Turing test.
Because we just had an experience earlier, just a week ago or so, right?
Oh, yeah. Okay. So, yeah, when we were visiting my dad.
Yeah.
So he said that he was talking to a customer service representative for some utility company or something. And he had this like 2 or 3 minute interaction with what he thought was a human.
Right.
And then at the end of it, he needed more help and he found out it was not human, but a robot.
So funny.
And he had absolutely no idea.
Just totally blindsided by...
He was like, wait a second.
Wait a minute. This isn't a human operator.
I was talking to a robot.
That's so interesting. It like, basically he was in like the, for more options, press one.
But it was human.
But it was a human. He was having a conversation with it.
Right.
Right.
And it was responding authentically.
Right.
Rather than just press 1, 2, 3.
Mm-hmm. So interesting.
Yeah.
It's just so interesting to me because he's not an idiot in any stretch of the imagination.
No,
he's extremely smart. He's been trained to like with all these sorts of things,
mm-hmm.
all like you know, human like observation
behavior,
stuff. You know,
extremely observant.
And the robot tricked him.
Yep.
And I mean, maybe part of it was because he wasn't expecting in that context. But like, usually you can sort of like feel it, right? It's so interesting. I don't know, like, how did he realize it was a robot?
Something he said something about its final response to him, where it transferred him to a...
another person?
Yeah. And I think it said something like, let me transfer you to
a human representative.
A representative. And something about the way it said that, he's like, wait a second, that was a robot.
It was like a live representative, maybe, or like a human representative.
Maybe, yeah, maybe it's a live representative.
And you're like, wait a second, are you not alive? Is that not what's happening here?
Who am I talking to?
Because no human would say that.
Right, exactly. No one would say that.
Let me transfer you to a live representative. They'd be like, I'm going to transfer you to like booking or whatever. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, exactly. So interesting.
Right?
Because they didn't even tell him then. There was no indication that he was talking to a robot.
None. And then he was.
And then he was.
And then his response made me think about what you've talked about as the uncanny valley.
Yeah.
So, which I think we've talked about it in the past a little bit, but just recap what it is.
Oh, uncanny valley is there's this like graph of like how comfortable humans are with images and like personifications of stuff. So like caricatures and like really cutesy robots with like very minimal features, but they still have like a couple of eyes that are very cute, right?
Yeah.
And then as you make it more human-like, there's a point where it becomes both too human and like not human enough. And it hits this like deep dip of discomfort.
Yeah.
And there's a theoretical like other side of this valley where it's indistinguishable from human.
Wow.
Yeah.
And so that's the uncanny valley.
That's the uncanny valley is the discomfort.
Wait a
you're like, oh God, that's got too many teeth and not enough fingers. I don't know.
Yeah.
Sort of thing.
Or even if it looks totally human, that's even worse.
Well, right? If it looks totally human, but there's just something wrong about it and you can't put your finger on why it looks wrong.
Or even you know.
Yeah, even if you know.
Alive. I can imagine if you didn't, if you knew it wasn't alive, like Steven Spielberg's movie AI way back in the day, and it looked alive and it reacted in a living way, that would definitely be uncanny.
That would be very uncanny. One of the classic examples that people use is they have for a long time now had these robot head mannequins where they're like, oh, we can make human facial expressions on these. And it's just like kind of a human head that's got like steel rods that it's attached to on a table. It looks very strange. And it'll go through like a gambit of human faces and like expressions. And you're like, wow, that's creepy. Woo. Cause it's like, there's also like, I think there's this plasticky sense to like most like latex or whatever they use for faux human skin. I think it's better than actually using human skin, even if we were to like grow it. Well, it's no immune system, right? But that's a classic example of it. It's people are like, wow, that's really creepy. It's very interesting.
I wonder if part of the creepiness of it is that we are, you know, really programmed to respond with some amount of empathy for a human.
Yeah.
And I wonder if somebody, this would be interesting, I wonder if somebody who is someone who is sociopathic would have an experience of the uncanny valley, or if they would not.
That would be interesting.
Because it seems to me that on the human side, you know, that there's something in us that would find that creepy, that would find that disconcerting. But what is that?
I mean, it could be that, like, if it's trying to pretend to be a human,
but why is it pretending?
Well,
okay, pretending.
Yeah, why is it pretending to be a human?
Can you trust it?
Can you trust it? Because it's obviously not a human, but it's trying to trick me into thinking that it's a human.
It looks like a human, but it's not a human.
Right. And there's also like, there's like a long history of...
But it's the emotional reaction that I'm talking about.
There's definitely an emotional reaction.
Because I'm talking about if you see a lemon, if you see something that looks like a lemon, but you find out that it's actually an orange, okay?
Yeah.
You're not going to have an emotional reaction to that. You're going to be like, oh.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you'll have a very... There's actually a really fun party trick where you like blindfold someone. You like... then you... crack a lemon rind in front of their nose and have them bite into an onion, they will like, it actually is painful. It like totally, they have like a jarring experience.
Yeah.
It's very weird.
Wow, because the senses aren't aligned. But
like you said, there's no emotional response to that. Yeah. It could be that compassion sort of thing.
Yeah.
It could be like...
I like the trust thing. I think it could definitely have to do with trust.
Yeah. Because like
we rely on our interactions with a person to determine whether we can trust someone.
Yeah. And part of that is their visage, because like...
But then when we don't trust someone, we don't feel disconcerted. We're just like, hey, I can't trust that person.
Right.
So the disconcerting part of it is the uncanny part, the fact that we're like, whoa. That's where I'm thinking it might have to do with empathy, because...
Yeah.
We don't have empathy thus far for machines.
I mean, we have some amount of empathy for them, especially as they become more human.
Like, well, that's the thing. We you know, that's the thing. I wonder if future generations, or even as we, you know, we might have more of an experience of that, or that might be a generational divide in the future where someone perceives, like, we're the younger generations, maybe your kids.
Yeah, they're like, they're just talking to those machines.
But they would be like, well, what
but
do you
this
mean?
Is, this
they
is,
have empathy and they don't experience the uncanny valley, whereas we will still experience it.
Right. You know, they're like, this is Kyle, who happens to be a phone.
Right.
And the older generation's like, it's a phone.
Which is so interesting, because that's exactly what Steven Spielberg was addressing in the 80s in the movie AI.
Right.
It's precisely what he was addressing, because the mother in that scenario could not overcome the uncanny valley.
Yeah, she couldn't.
She couldn't deal with it.
Yeah, well, because it was, I mean, there was something in that movie, it was super weird. Definitely recommend watching it for anyone else.
It is but very like, dystopian, just a warning.
Super dystopian, very sad.
Like the end, I won't tell you what it is, but it was so incredibly anguish-filled sadness for me. And yet I'm not, I know that I'm kind of not like, not everyone has that reaction.
You're biased in that
but
sense.
But for me, It was actually the worst ending of any movie I've ever seen in my life.
Honestly.
Because it was so emotional.
I even had like an anguish reaction to it.
Yeah.
That's not something that I get evoked very often.
Yeah.
But
be that as it may, it's a fantastic film.
Fantastic. Character in that movie, the like little kid, there was just like something off about him.
Right? Yeah, he wasn't truly human-like.
Yeah, which was like incredible acting by this kid. Holy shit.
Yeah.
I think it was the same kid from Sixth Sense, wasn't it?
I think it was. You're right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. He was really bizarre in that movie too. Maybe he's just so weird.
I don't know. He's grown up to be a fine young man.
Oh yeah, he's old now, isn't he?
He is, yeah.
We're talking about a movie
like
from the
80s.
Yes, he is. Ooh. Anyway. Well, we're already like starting to empathize with our machines.
We are.
I mean, especially as they sing to us now, right?
They sing to us.
Well, yours does. Your refrigerator.
Oh, yes. Well, I do appreciate what
And your washing machine and your dishwasher.
I actually turned that function on in my car, which you thought was hilarious.
It's super funny. Yeah. Russell thought it was funny too. It's like, you know, as the machines find ways to communicate with us, or as we program ways for them to communicate with us, you know, we're going to empathize with them.
Right.
I mean, it's just like, and we have this like inner desire to like have a pack, right? To have like a group. We're very social animals, mm-hmm. you know? So as soon as we figure out how something else is communicating, we're going to communicate with it.
On a positive side of, as far as like not experiencing as much of the uncanny valley, I'm wondering if people who are autistic might have a different reaction to
uncanny valley stuff.
To the uncanny valley.
Yeah.
So I wonder if autism will have a mediating effect on the uncanny valley, because autistic people perceive social cues, social interactions differently.
Right.
And so having the machine as part of that, right, reacting to you rather than an actual human being might be, in a sense, more soothing. It might be less confusing.
Yeah.
If it were a machine versus like, I'll just be completely forthright here.
Yeah.
When I'm 90, 100, I want to have a robot caregiver.
Yeah.
I don't want, like, I would rather have a robot than have a human nurse.
Right.
Because if I have a human nurse, then I'm going to feel the need to take care of them. And I'm going to feel like I need to respond to them.
In a certain way.
And, like, figure out what they need. And this is just how my mind works. I'm just programmed, you know, I just programmed to love to care for people. Mm-hmm. And I want them to be okay. I want them to be happy when they're, you know, there. And and so that would be a whole thing. Whereas with a machine, all that, I don't have any of that pressure.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have to worry about any of that.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's not like a dire pressure.
Having a human see my 100-year-old body versus
a nurse bot who's designed
100%.
For this. They're like, hello, I'm your nurse bot. And are you ready to have your bath? And you're like, okay.
Yes. Yes.
I would love my bath. Sweet.
So to me, that would be more comfortable to have a robot. I like your nurse bot. I like that.
Yeah.
Have a nurse bot versus a human.
Right. That makes sense.
Now, I mean, there's some people who are in that field of work who might be like, hey, what about our jobs? But it's not that people won't have jobs. We've talked about this before. The jobs will change.
Yes. That's always the way it is.
Are changing.
Besides, a lot of people that are in... Besides that, a lot of people are in hospice work are older people.
They are.
Like, my grandmother is doing hospice stuff because she's retired and she doesn't want to like deal with the pressure of like the normal doctoring environment.
Yes.
And so she does hospice.
And
because she still wants to do something she's good at.
And see, hospice is a high level skill.
Yeah.
Hospice is not something that a robot is going to do as well as a human.
No.
And I think that's what all of this is doing. It's moving humans towards the higher level skills, towards the higher level interactions. Even in my dad's experience, it used to be some incredibly bored, incredibly disenfranchised,
like
customer 16
service year
representative,
old. Yeah,
right, or 22 or whatever, just like, oh, I hate this job.
I have been sitting here for 8 hours, sir.
Saying the same things over and over again, which humans hate.
Same script. Like every single day for 12 hours a day. That sounds like a nightmare, right?
Exactly. And so now they don't have that job. They have the higher level job and there's more of them.
Yep.
Okay. And then there's the jobs that are created of managing the AI.
Yeah.
So in programming and reprogramming.
Programming and making sure the machines are working and updating the machines. And there's going to be lots of that. Mm-hmm. And eventually we'll figure out, oh, we need more materials and we'll go to space for them because there's a lot of materials in space. I'm going to get off on a tangent.
that's true. Yeah. So not forcing slave labor on the earth for these lithium materials that we need is so horrific.
Yeah. Anyway. But tangent. One thing that I have in my experience with like the Uncanny Valley is that I seem to have a better sense in images and like text when it's written by a robot versus written by a human.
So you can tell the difference better.
I can tell the difference better and I feel it more viscerally, especially with pictures. But like social interactions, I would definitely like not notice, I feel like. I feel like I would just like be like, wow, this person's great to interact with. I'm so excited. And just be like, oh, they've got machines, they've got wires in their body. Okay, whatever, it's fine.
Yeah, right. Well, it's interesting because I think as you interact more with machines, you do come to recognize it. So
yeah.
Now I can recognize if somebody's used ChatGPT, for instance, to write an email. I can see it.
Yeah.
But part of that is that, and here's a hint for all of you writers, everybody who's using ChatGPT, take out the first line and take out the in conclusion. 100% take those out, you're good to go. Because ChatGPT right now is programmed to say, I hope this letter finds you well. Like, what?
Okay.
Who says that?
Yeah.
So, and it says that every single time. So take that out and then take out at the very last paragraph where it says, in conclusion, take that out.
Right.
And you'll be good to go. You don't need any of that.
Yeah, ChatGPT sort of writes like I did in like the fifth grade.
Yes.
Like
trained to write the way that.
Because like you're like, all right, here's the introductory part. Here's the thing I actually want to write about in conclusion, because I don't want to have a transition sentence into the conclusion.
Well, I mean, that format is standard. Okay.
Yeah.
And
but
it
it's
makes
like,
sense. And it's a good format.
It's good enough.
There's a little bit of
personhood.
Repetition or
routinized.
Yeah. It's just a little bit too, well, it's robotic, right?
It's so, very programmatic.
But it's robotic in a much more sophisticated way.
Yes.
Yeah, but I mean, it's continuing to develop too.
Yeah.
And
we were talking about something earlier.
Turing, you said that he solved the Enigma machines. So
He's like the basically the father of programming, honestly.
That's amazing.
He, with his room sized like computers, he found a way to cryptographically break the Enigma machine. Because, like, the thing is, right, by modern standards, the Enigma machine is not very fancy.
Right.
It's basically like a couple of Caesarian ciphers that are like kind of compounded and like melded into each other. And there's a couple of replacements or whatever. It's extremely complicated. And it's incredible that they managed to do it in a mechanical format.
Yeah.
Wow. And like, obviously, I don't know if anyone's like had like gotten the chance to play with the Enigma machine. We have done one
at the Museum of Science and Industry.
Yeah, we have one at the museum. Yeah. Mm-hmm. We have one at the Museum of Science and Industry. And, they are not easy to operate. There are like five like wires that you have to get put in different places. You got to make sure it's on the right reel or whatever. It's like a whole thing. And then we had to like, we tried to do that. We tried to solve it without having the machine. And then once we had the machine, it was like a lot easier, but he was on his way to solving it.
We had to have the codes that they were using. Because the problem is, right? Didn't we?
Well, we got the machine and the codes at the same time.
I know,
because
we
stole that U-boat.
Yes.
Which was really funny.
Yeah, if you're ever in Chicago, Museum of Science and Industry, so cool. You can tour that U-boat.
Yeah.
It's so cool.
If you're tall, you'll have to duck. That's just a fact. Mm-hmm.
I can't believe they lived in there and smoked cigarettes. And disgusting. Slept on top of torpedoes.
Yeah, I mean, incredible. You know, comfortable, whatever. It's the best bunk in the house. Anyway.
And some of those guys were tall.
Yeah, they had to have been.
Because, I mean, Germans are tall.
You had to have really good interpersonal relationships with your coworkers.
Or none whatsoever. Just be like,
Yeah, but like, I feel like if you're living in that close of quarters.
I think that the military training, it's like, you withhold any of your own personal,
You're just there for the job sort of thing.
Yeah.
Anyway, we're on a tangent.
Very much
Father programming, I don't remember what else he like kind of made, but he definitely like had a lot of really like forward ideas.
Yeah, that's incredible.
It was really, really cool. I think they made a movie about it as well. I don't remember recently.
Right.
Yeah.
Let me see what that's called.
It's probably called Turing.
Really?
I think so. Right. But yeah, so the Turing test, that is going to soon be kind of conquered, I feel like.
I know. By artificial intelligence.
It's already starting to become like actually conquered.
Yeah.
We've seen it with, you know,
Ex Machina.
Ex Machina?
Ex Machina? Is that how you pronounce
it? Usually how you pronounce Ex Machina.
Based on the 1983 biography of Alan Turing, The Enigma.
Cool.
There's also another one, The Imitation Game.
Yeah, that one was about specifically code breaking the Enigma machine.
Okay. Interesting.
Yeah, very interesting.
Thank you for joining us on another episode of ADAI, Author-Driven Artificial Intelligence. We hope that our discussion has inspired you to embrace the incredible potential of chat-based AI in your work. If you've enjoyed this episode, don't forget to subscribe, rate, and share ADAI. To learn more about how to leverage author-driven AI in your business, visit our website at adaiproductivity.com. Until next time, keep exploring and get ahead of the curve with chat-based AI.